This week, Paul Sherry on the Tanana Chiefs restoring satellite service to villages, Emil Nadi on the Alaska Native Foundation, the Ammonic Dancers, Mike Harper, Stan Howitt on threats to the Alaska Native consumer. Potlatch, a program about Alaska Natives for Alaska Natives. Seven weeks ago, Potlatch told you about the end of a satellite service to the bush. Now some good news. The Tanana Chiefs have started this service again. Here is Paul Sherry, who works for the Tanana Chiefs.
During the month of October, the time was sort of still on the air, but nobody was running the programming at all. We have arranged it so that starting this last week, on November 11th, something like this, we're starting the programming operating out of the Tanana Chiefs' offices. And pretty much we've transferred control from state-operated schools to Tanana Chiefs, and we're going to be responsible financially, program-wise, this kind of thing, during the last 8 or 10 months, depending on what happens of the ATS-1 educational time. Tanana Chiefs Conference, as an organization, is both an advocate and an assistance-providing organization for the villages. It's in a lot of ways more sensible that Tanana Chiefs be the focal point for this programming. As a matter of fact, if the programming was going to continue under JOM funds, this is the way it was going to be set up anyway. We're just doing it on a volunteer basis now, and using the monies out of different budgets to support the programming. The 10 hours that we have, a lot of it's going to be somewhat the same as before. We've got boarding home programming time. We've got teacher traffic. We've got some time for community exchange. We are adding in a couple of hours a week in which we as a health authority can contact the health aides that are on. There's about 16 health aides that are on the system, 18, maybe 19 if you include the ATS-6 stations. And we're going to have time to talk with them about pay problems and administrative hassles, various educational programs that we're thinking of implementing and seeing how they react to it. We're going to be putting in a lot of varying programming over the next 10 months, putting on a lot of music, a lot of tapes of conventions and of meetings, potlatches, dances, this kind of thing. Rotating the amount of the type of programming that we have. We'll also be having guests from the different federal and state agencies whose services are provided in the villages, talking about their programs and hoping through this kind of thing to promote the village feedback about what kind of operations are going on in the villages, building of facilities, health and education services that are provided, this kind of thing.
I asked about the satellite transmission schedule.
It's currently all in the evening. The earliest time we have is around 5:45 to 6:45 on Tuesday night, but it's Monday through Friday, and the hours between 7 and 10 o'clock, we have programming on a lot of those hours, those different nights. We're currently negotiating with the Governor's Office of Telecommunication to change some of those hours to make it a little more convenient for people listening, and also to give us some daytime hours so that we can do business during business hours with village corporations, councils, boarding home people, this kind of thing, teachers, and we can do some direct communication when it's most needed. It's also easier for people to get to the stations during the day. It's easier for the, in many cases where the health aides have the clinics and the radios in their homes, for people to come during the day, during clinic hours, and use the satellite then. The villages that are on the system are mostly ones around Galena and around Fort Yukon areas, a total of 16. And now with the addition of the several of the ATS-6 stations, Minto, Nenana, Nikolai, and then other major stations in the state, Juneau and Valdez, we have a pretty large ATS-1 network still, and we hope to, for example, we're thinking about renewing a program that was going last fall where students in high school and elementary school in Juneau, Tanana, Nome, at Fort Yukon could all talk to each other during the days about what they were doing. And with this expanded network, we may be able to continue the same kind of thing.
Paul Sherry, telling about one of the Tanana Chief's services to Alaska Natives. Now, another Native organization serving Natives, as we hear from Emil Nadi.
The Alaska Native Foundation is a nonprofit corporation which was formed in 1968 and reorganized in 1970 in line with the new national laws governing nonprofit organizations. For the past 2 years, we've limited our activities to the area of helping the regional corporations organize to implement the Claims Act that was passed in 1971. In the early days, we put on seminars revolving around management concepts, investment policies, oil and gas leasing procedures. Generally, we were providing a service to the newly formed organizations. We've also had attorneys on contract to us that would give us analysis of specific areas of the Act. We've also had national accounting firms that did some studies on tax implications of certain sections of the Act. All these are very technical analysis that had to be looked at, and we thought we could do them one time more efficiently than having 12 regional corporations do the original research themselves. We're funded from a number of sources. Primarily, we're operating off of a grant from the Ford Foundation. It was a multiple-year grant. We're now on our last year, and we're now project-oriented. We've picked up several contracts in the past 5 or 6 months. One of the contracts we're working on now is we're producing a history book on Alaska centered around the claims. It's probably a different look at history than we're used to. We'll go into a little bit. It'll be a 450-page book, probably 10 chapters, divided roughly in the following manner. It'll be early history prior to contact with Western civilization. It'll be a section on the contact with Russians. There'll be a section on territorial government, the coming of statehood, and then we'll shift to the organizing around the state of Native organizations and the formation of AFN, gearing up for the land claims fight, and it'll we'll trace the fight through Congress, and then we'll have a section on the Act itself. There'll be no profit involved in it. As a matter of fact, we're wondering now how we're going to meet some of the production costs. We have plans now to produce a hardbound history book with pictures and graphs and charts and maps. We expect it to be a high-grade, high-quality book and as factual as we can make it. We're aiming at that about the 10th grade level. We hope that it gets into the school system. And there's been a great need to pull together materials on land claims. I know that there are a number of land claims classes being taught in high schools and in colleges and universities. And the instructors are spending a great deal of time trying to outline the course and collect material, reading material and background material for the course. And we hope that this book will fill that need. We're writing a book of facts, and we hope that facts are useful to all elements of society. And it's a factual book on what happened in Alaska, and I hope that it's used extensively throughout Alaska.
Emil Nadi, about the Alaska Native Foundation. Now another service from the Ammonic Dancers with commentary by Father Jim Poole of station KNOM.
The next dance is about a man with a sled going for driftwood. The man is pushing the sled full of wood, and he recognizes that he's getting to be an old man, and his neck starts bothering him, then his legs. He's really getting old, not like when he was young. This is done by, I believe, Tommy Moses and Willie Moore. Two men dancing, one sitting, one kneeling. Three women standing in back of them in their very colorful cuss-box. The man with the sled going for driftwood.
Yeah.
Thanks to Father Jim Poole, KNOM, and the Ammonic Dancers. Because of land claims, people from Ammonic, as well as other areas of Alaska, have a little more money than before, and more consumer problems. The Assistant Attorney General for Alaska, Stan Howitt, and the Executive Director of Rural Cap, Mike Harper, comment.
We really have had a problem with some of the air carriers. Some carriers are leaving a particular route in favor of going up to the slope and leaving aircraft that might not be suitable for the trade or the consumers in that particular village or that particular region. And I just can tell you that this summer, or maybe it was the summer before, we had people that ordered 4x8 regular sheet of plywood, and because it was shipped by a smaller aircraft than that was usually used, I believe the paneling was cut to fit the aircraft, and of course you just ruined a good piece of $18 piece of plywood, or in Bethel I think they're going for $20 or something better than that. I think that's probably one of the biggest things, and the way to get to the root of the problem is to have representation of all the people that are affected by the problem, as we did in Bethel, I believe, in January of 73, and have a regional Bush hearing is what we had. We invited the people that were principals in the air carrier, and in that case it was Weens. We invited the regulatory agents, and that was the Civil Aeronautics Board, the CAB, and the Alaska Transportation Commission. And we had the individual village council presidents cite some of the problems created by the what they considered very, very poor air carrier service. And the regulators were there. They promised action. I believe one of the high officials in Weens was there. He heard the problems. And I believe the situation I hope it got better. I haven't heard as a lot of cries of despair as I did before in the Bethel area. I know that we aren't perfect by any means yet, though.
I asked Howitt how to prevent goods ordered from large cities from arriving broken in the villages.
What is happening, from what I could see, and we have a few complaints now coming in of this sort, there usually is a disclaimer. In other words, the airline saying, I'm not responsible. Then the place where the goods are stored, the people that moved it over there might be just volunteers, and the goods there could be left unguarded and could be pilfered or possibly broken at that point as well. And I think there has to be some better order, I think, in the handling and in the actual protection of these goods. This is a new angle that I've seen, and in fact, I just got a letter recently from John Sackett of Dion, who informed me that, and I got a letter also from the individual who was complaining about the goods arriving not only damaged, but also some goods were actually taken out, and it would look like, you know, stolen or just removed. So I think in that particular case, we'd have to take a look at the airline's responsibility or the charter or whatever it is, and see how you can better plan to protect those goods, and also for a possible look at the goods at some point before it arrives at destination to make sure they're okay, and then thereafter. Now, this is a very, very difficult, and there should be adequate insurance to cover it. And then there again, the average person out in the bush maybe doesn't understand of how to apply for insurance, or if it's a very crucial thing like a hi-fi, how to insure it against that kind of damage. I'm sure they'd spend the few cents to do so. So yes, in that regard, there certainly is. The recent one we had was, I think, a 68-pound speaker, hi-fi speaker, someone had saved up a lot of money for and finally got, and then when it arrived there, it was just smashed. We're going to try, and so far as getting these kind of complaints, to see if we can't get a better adjustment or a better kind of a freight handling, if that's at all possible. Some of this may be just dreams. I just don't know at this point. We have to find out what kind of response we'll get. When it's shipped on the aircraft, it might be it might have been damaged there. And then, of course, you really can't. As you can see, there are so many handlers on it that unless you do have the insurance thing, so maybe the answer is a little consumer education to get very, very proper insurance when they're getting something through that's fragile and that costs a lot of money. Now, that's quite different than what the kind of complaints we think may be up in the villages, by the way, which I'd like to comment upon if you have the time. I'm concerned more with things like mail-order houses that don't deliver merchandise. I'm concerned with problems of insurance persons possibly going to the villages and selling insurance that they don't. People think they're getting one thing, and it's really something else again as far as the coverage that they have. I think there may be a problem in out-of-state dealers in fish products, for example, or other products that furs or the like that might come in and tell the people one thing on price and give them another, or possibly never pay the price for the particular product that they went out for. And this could be anything from the fish to fish products, or it could be furs, as I say, or even could be ivory pieces. At this point, we just don't have any real background to find out. People are going to have to tell us. And we have been notified with a few of these problems, and we're going to try to pursue them as quickly as we can.
I think everyone in the village knows that you do have money. Even the smallest village is getting perhaps in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. Certainly not every year, but we've been 3 years into the land claims now, and so there is 3 years' worth of payments. So it's enough money to attract these guys with schemes and to make money, and they might pawn themselves off as special technical assistance people in areas of perhaps finance or management or stocks and bonds or something like this. Those areas that very few native people have much expertise on, much knowledge about. And I don't know. It's my belief that about every village I've ever seen has good, strong leadership, and that's going to be the salvation to this whole land claims movement, that the people in the community that are the leaders are going to have to be, and they're generally the board of directors, are going to have to take the responsibility to review each person or company that's in a community that wants to make a buck. And I'm saying probably the way I would handle it, and I would pass that on certainly, is probably say no right off. And if the guy's really got a good plan, he'll come back. And then I think I might say no again. And I think I see this happening in most communities. But I think the best thing is a wise judgment and very careful counsel of your regional leadership if you don't have the capability in the village. And I certainly think that there is that leadership ability in a village.
One of the best ways of discovering who you're dealing with is possibly to make an inquiry to the Consumer Protection Office. Now, we're not interested in any of the profit angles or anything to do with that, you see, Mike. That's not the concern. The concern is the reputability of who you're dealing with. Are they the kind of people that they say they are? Is that financier a financier? Or has he gone bankrupt before? Or has he been in trouble with the authorities before? Sometimes you cannot tell. There are many confidence men, many swindlers that are extremely adept. They really know what they're doing. And not only that, but they'll be your best friend. And they'll come in there very excited with a good scheme, and it just may fall flat and be a good trick. The only way you can check this out, I think the The village people, yes, the council certainly has to be strong, and if they're really suspicious, to let us know about it, and we can check it out for them, I think. I think it's a very part of, I think, state government to watch this kind of thing. I don't see why, you know, they should have to depend upon just their own ways when I know that they won't have the kind of checking system we could use.
Potlatch, produced in the studios of KUAC in College in cooperation with KTOO Juneau, KOTZ Kotzebue, and KYUK Bethel, under Title I of the Higher Education Act.